On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, headline number one this week, the Mark Foley scandal, uproar, and the House announcing an investigation over to find out who knew what and when.
The fact is that I don't know. Who knew what, when. We know that there are reports of people that knew it and kind of fed it out or leaked it to the press. That's why we've asked for investigation.
Specifically, Mark is asked that you be told that between the ages of 13 and 15, he was molested by a clergyman.
The United States and our coalition allies formally pass the mantle of international military leadership in Afghanistan to NATO ISAF.
You're talking about a nice, quiet, rural setting that this happened in. You know, you would never imagine that it would happen in a nice Amish community.
The closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange had a different ring to it on Tuesday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has been around for 110 years, but it doesn't often make history.
Also in the news, a bloody week in Iraq and somber assessments on Iraq and Afghanistan from U.S. senators. North Korea rattles the nuclear saber again. Violence shatters the peaceful world of the Amish. Housing prices fall. Gasoline prices, too. The stock market soars. And more this hour on Point. We'll go inside the week's headlines in our weekly news roundtable. With us this week from Washington is Julie Mason, White House and Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Julie, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks.
Also with us from Washington, Kim Strassel, editorial board member for the Wall Street Journal. Kim, great to have you back.
Nice to be back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Julie, and Kim.
Let's dive straight in. Julie, you're there in the thick of it. What's your top story this week?
Well, it's got to be Foley. There's nothing else anyone's talking about here in Washington.
And what does it all mean in the end? I mean, is this the hit that pushes the Republicans out of a majority in the House? Is this the blow that cracks Republican solidarity? How do you assess it?
Well, I don't know. I'm not part of the school that thinks there's going to be a huge Democratic swamping of Republicans. I think it's a terrible story for the party. But I think we're not quite clear on how it's going to affect the elections. For one thing, they're almost 5 weeks away, and a lot can happen in 5 weeks, as you well know.
And now it's off to the House Ethics Committee. Is this a one-week wonder as a story? Does it get buried in that committee, or is this an ongoing story?
Gay sex scandal. It's going to go on and on forever. But I do think that there are some other scandals in the past that seemed to go on forever that kind of died with a fizzle. You think of lobbying reform. Not really much came of that, and that could be the end for this, too. Eventually.
Everybody was up in arms over Abramoff and all the rest, and not so much there. Now, Kim Strassel, as you look out across the peaks and valleys of this week, what's your top story?
Well, one thing that was actually very overshadowed by the Foley scandal but may actually have more resonance is the twin news that the stock market had hit an all-time high and the gas prices had gone down by 20% over the past 2 months. This is good news for the economy. It's going to probably really inspire a lot of especially low-income voters out there. They've been worried about their pocketbooks. You know, this 20% drop in gas prices in particular equals about $7 billion of extra cash out there for Americans to spend. And this may actually resonate more in the elections because often people go out and vote based on how happy they're feeling about their well-being at the moment, and things are looking good right now.
And Kim, you're at the Wall Street Journal. What about that stock market? Does it have legs, or could we be looking at a peak with this record high at the Dow?
Well, no, I think one thing that's interesting is that the stock market has been kind of moving ahead on fundamentals here. I mean, this is partly a reaction to it. I mean, it's reacting to gas prices in particular, which had been a great big worry out there. When people have those extra $7 billion to go out and spend, they pour it into other sectors of the economy, particularly big giants that had been struggling over the last couple of years, Walmart, for instance, low-income Americans in particular. When they have free dollars, they tend to go spend it in some lower-end retailers. But also, lower gas prices means lower inflation, and that is something that is encouraging a lot of people out there. So I think there's some real staying power to this.
So an economy humming along beneath the headlines, though there's more to say there, and we'll look at it. Jack Beatty, what's number one on your list this week?
Well, you know, nobody died in Foleygate that we know. And yet, according to a draft EPA analysis reported by Elizabeth Shogren on NPR, the soot standards, the standards about particulate matter adopted last month by the EPA, are less rigorous than those recommended by scientists retained by the EPA to estimate that. And the scientists estimate that 4,000 more Americans a year, up to 4,000 a year, will die because the stricter standards have not been adopted. And, of course, if you look at what the electric utility industry, which is perhaps the main purveyor of particulate matter in the air, contributed to the Bush campaign, $4.8 million in 2000.
So never mind the sex scandal. You're looking at the very air we breathe and the money soot nexus there. Top story from Jack Beatty. Let's wheel around with all three of you, if we may, and look at Foley and the Republicans for a minute on the home stretch to midterm elections, very important ones, indeed, by everybody's measure here. Kim Strassel, Julie says she's not in the camp that sees Democrats swamping the Republicans this time. We've heard this week from Republicans, Matt Continetti at the Weekly Standard, Richard Viguerie, who are afraid that indeed just might happen. How do you see it from your perch at the Wall Street Journal editorial board?
Look, I do think, look, the big worry here for Republicans is that this is going to depress turnout. I don't think this is the kind of story where I actually go out and people say, well, I was going to vote Republican, now I'm going to vote Democrat. The bigger issue is more just that they're going to say, I'm so sick of all of you jokers, I'm not going out to vote at all. You know, that being said, one of the questions that's going to matter here is how whether or not the Republicans are perceived to have known about this and whether or not there was anything else that they could have done earlier. And I'm actually of the opinion that they couldn't have, and for two specific reasons. One is, if you look out there at the original emails the leadership was supposed to have seen, this question of whether or not they should have acted on those, we now know that there were other media organizations that had those emails. The FBI saw them this summer. The FBI described them as vanilla. The media organizations did not run with them. And you also have to put them.
Of course, there were emails, and then there were text messages, and by the time you got to the bottom of that pile, it wasn't vanilla anymore. I've read them.
No, not at all. But we're talking about what these guys actually saw a year ago when they were supposed to have acted. And I think that fact then has to be factored into something else, which is our general culture and society at the moment. We have as a nation, and I think this is an incredibly good thing, been having a discussion about how we do not point our fingers at gay men and say that simply because they are gay, there is something untoward about them having contact with young people. I mean, this is what the entire debate in America was about over the gay Boy Scout leader issue, which was there was a camp out there that said, okay, well, you know, if there's a guy who's gay and he's with young people, there must be something wrong
with
him.
But this wasn't about
normal.
Mark Foley teaching kids how to tie square knots. I mean, this was about masturbation and, you know, get out your measuring stick and all kinds of kinky stuff.
Of course, but what I'm saying is that was not contained in the original emails. The original emails, the FBI said, were vanilla. So the choice that faced Republicans at that time, which was, are you going to point your finger at a man, and let's be honest, entirely because he was gay, and say that, therefore, we're going to put extra scrutiny on him and launch an investigation based on some emails that didn't necessarily ring the alarm bells of the FBI or even other news organizations?
I don't know. I've got questions on that, but let's listen first to Denny Hastert. Here he was at a news conference yesterday outside his district office in Batavia, Illinois, offering a public apology.
I'm deeply sorry that this has happened. And the bottom line is that we're taking responsibility because ultimately, as someone has said in Washington before, the buck stops here.
And then the speaker was asked outside Chicago, would he step down?
Anytime that a person has to, as a leader, be on the hot seat and he is a detriment to the party, there ought to be a change. I became speaker in a situation like that. I don't think that's the case. I said I haven't done anything wrong, obviously.
Chicago Tribune, listen to that. Their headline was, Blame Me, But Not Too Much. Julie Mason, what about, Kim Strassel says, look, they couldn't pounce on this guy just because he was a gay man friendly with young people. On the other hand, we had Tom Reynolds on here yesterday. It was his top aide, who was also top aide to Mark Foley. Are we suckers to believe that these guys behind the scenes, beyond the email messages, had no idea what was going on here?
Well, there's two things I'd like to say about that, Tom. First, the more the Republican Party gets into the weeds on this investigation about who knew what when, the more people in America are going to be tuning it out because it's getting too complex, it's getting too navel-gazing. And so that works to their advantage. Putting the whole House on trial about this really works to their political advantage. Also, I would say that there's an emerging storyline I'm aware of that Kim alluded to a little bit about the media dropped the ball on this story. I've been getting a lot of emails from readers, particularly Republican readers, who've heard this from their local party, who are saying this is the media's fault because the media knew about this. Well, let's get to the bottom of that. The pages in question very early on who produced these early emails and IMs would not allow their names to be used. And by most newspaper standards, people who anonymously make allegations against public figures are not allowed to do so. You have to put your name to it.
But
so,
drop the ball. Julie, Dennis Hastert is saying this was leaked. He's unhappy that it was leaked. That I really don't understand. Why not have it out there? Are they dropping the ball or leaking?
But this gets into, I mean, what he is alluding to, which has in no way been substantiated, was that, look, the way that these original emails ended up coming to the spotlight last week was that they were put on a kind of suspicious-looking blog, and it kind of looked as though maybe it had been thrown up a few weeks beforehand.
I'm joined this hour by Julie Mason, White House and Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Kim Strassel's with us from Washington as well, editorial board member of the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Right now, let's take a call from Washington, D.C. Richard is on the line. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. I know this isn't exactly the sexiest story out there this week, but I wanted to talk about the Amish school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as someone who grew up in the Christian tradition, I guess I'd describe myself as an agnostic today, but I was incredibly touched by the way that the Amish have responded. And I think that they really have, it really teaches a lot of Christians in this country, or people who call themselves Christians, a lesson.
Because of the forgiveness piece, Richard, is that what touched you, moved
because
you?
Because of their forgiveness, because of their humility. I mean, faced with probably one of the most horrible crimes that can possibly be committed, you don't see them on CNN. You don't see them begging for money or for vengeance. It is just an incredibly touching display of true Christianity and the tradition that all Christians are taught, but I think rarely actually carry out.
Richard, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, it has been remarkable this week, the kind of back-to-back images on the television from Amish country with that sorrow and that fortitude and forgiveness. And then in Washington, the kind of squalor, somebody called it a circular firing squad. I mean, you can't help but miss the kind of dramatic, dynamic tension between those two.
No, you can't. And the circular firing squad, let's talk about that. I mean, John Boehner, the majority leader, gave, by my reckoning, four different stories over as many days about when he told the speaker, what he told the speaker, and the consequences. You had Roy Blount, the whip, staking out an independent position, saying, I would have handled it differently. You had Mr. Reynolds saying, well, I told my supervisor about this. What do you expect me to do? Your supervisor? Buddy, you're elected. You're a congressman. You're not some worker in a factory. This has been a spectacle of mediocrity and panic among these leaders as one by one they blame one another. And now we have the spectacle of the speaker blaming George Soros for doing this. Presumably he was out there. I don't know. What was he doing? Was he writing these emails? Was he, you know, Svengali-like insinuating the news of them into the media? This is it. This is deep dish paranoia from the speaker.
We'll talk about that. Let's listen. Just yesterday, we had Tom Reynolds on. Of course, he's the head of the Republican National Committee to hold on to the House and insist that he knew only half the story, that he passed on what he knew to his supervisor, Dennis Hastert.
Tom, I've been on the record for 3 days. I support the speaker. I also support a full investigation. I have supported an investigation of the FBI. I've supported the investigation where the speaker has invited Governor Jeb Bush to have the Florida State Police come in. I have also supported and voted for, which I think was unanimous in a bipartisan fashion, that the Ethics Committee. I have nothing to hide. I want it all out.
K- Kim Strassel, where does the circular firing squad find an end and straighten out again here? What do you see going on in the Republican leadership?
I mean, it is a spectacle. Jack is completely right. But this is not unexpected. This is what happens when you have a party that is in as much trouble as it is going up to these elections. Every man is jumping ship. It's all about how they're going to distance themselves from this scandal. I mean, another thing, too, that I think that is worth pointing out that Jack didn't say, but, you know, these guys as well, there's a lot of political ambition showing its face here, too. There has been a decision by some people in the party that they are in such trouble that they are maybe looking at minority status now, and that people are running around to see who's next going to be speaker, who's going to be able to get ahead as a result of this problem. Now, yesterday, there did seem to be some common sense that took hold. The idea that throwing Denny Hastert under the big oncoming bus wasn't necessarily going to save the party. They got a little bit of unity, and they seem to have understood that unless they stick together on this, that they're just going to tear themselves apart all the more before Election Day.
Julie Mason,
it's true. It's unusual to see the Republicans in such disunity. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. Please go for it.
I wanted to add to what Kim was saying in that it is unusual to see the Republicans in such disunity, and Bush came out and supported Hastert earlier this week. But it's also important to remember that he supported Tom DeLay, too. Bush's support, the support of the party, is not some sort of magical cloak that's going to keep Hastert and others from danger. What this could come down to is what the FBI determines.
Let's go to Derek in Elkridge, Maryland. Hi, Derek. What do you think?
Hi. Yes, I have a response to a statement I heard Speaker Hastert make on NPR this morning. I just want to say very clearly that I am not a Democrat, neither am I a Republican.
All right.
But basically what he was saying this morning was that he takes full responsibility for what happened. I mean, what the heck is that supposed to mean, taking full responsibility? You know, you hear George Bush say he takes responsibility for Iraq. You hear all these politicians talking about taking responsibility. But interestingly enough, you know, I think that they're thoroughly embedded in this culture of corruption and immorality now. And, you know, I'm not moralistic, but...
But even so, where does that buck stop exactly? Derek, we've got it. Jack Beatty, we saw Dennis Hastert saying, the buck stops with me, and if there's a problem in my office, I'll fire a staffer.
It's really quite amazing. You know, it's as if that's the ritual thing you've got to say. You take responsibility as you deny responsibility. It's almost like a kind of octopus putting the ink in the air. You know, according to the Rasmussen, the latest Rasmussen poll, 61% of the public believe that the Republicans protected Foley, that they weren't concerned about the kid. They didn't want to bring this out. They didn't want to cause any trouble because they wanted the seat and they wanted Foley's dough, including Mr. Reynolds, who took $100,000 from him. And by the way, in just a week, there's been a 7-point swing away from Reynolds. He's lost 7 points in that race in upstate New York. He's now behind by 5 points there. Even 31% of Republicans, according to Rasmussen, think that the Republicans protected Foley. That was the main thing they were trying to do.
We're looking at the big threads of the week. Let's go to Boxborough, Massachusetts. And Mark, hi, Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you today?
We're good. What do you see out there, Mark?
Good. Well, it's interesting. If you had a Word of the Week contest this week, I think it would be a battle between lurid and denial. And the interesting thing is that they actually go hand in hand.
How do you mean?
Well, what you had here was a Speaker of the House who told you on Monday exactly how he approached this problem. Reynolds, who was the head of the campaign committee, brought it to his attention. And when Hastert was interviewed on CNN, he was asked, did that happen? He said, well, I don't really remember it, but if it did, I'm sure he just brought it to my attention among other things that might have affected campaigns. This thing was treated not as a real policy problem, how do we protect the pages? Mm-hmm. It was a political problem, just like Jack Beatty said. It was, how do we protect our seat? So what happens when you make policy decisions based exclusively on the political fallout, you end up with lurid stories like this. And it's not a difficult story for the public to grasp. That's why it crystallizes in this one lurid tale.
So what's the denial piece here? What's the denial piece, you would say, Mark?
The denial is exactly what your other two commenters suggested. The Republicans are going around saying, well, we couldn't have known that there was anything wrong here because those initial reports were really kind of vanilla. Well, the fact of the matter is, and I'm shocked to hear a reporter say that it should have stopped there and they shouldn't have asked any questions. The whole point was not to deny that there was a problem. The point was to say, well, what else is here? Because ABC, once they started asking questions, uncovered this whole sordid mess within hours. And that's what the Republican leadership would have done if they approached it as a real problem as opposed to merely a political issue that they needed to control and contain.
Mark, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Let's keep digging on this issue of denial and facts and all the rest. Bob Woodward stands right there in the middle of that. Of course, his book got uncovered a little before he intended and then got a bit upstaged by all the Foley drama. But Julie Mason, what about Woodward's revelations in this new book? He's been criticized for being overly friendly to the Bush administration, the stenographer for the White House. This time there's a big whack here.
It's true. And the one silver lining for the White House in the Foley scandal has been it's completely eclipsed the Woodward book. It got everyone to stop talking about Woodward. The White House has put out a couple of pieces of paper attempting to debunk some of the allegations in the Woodward book, the lead item of which is that Bush is intentionally misleading the country about the war in Iraq. And that seemed to have a moment of traction. And then it sort of went away and Woodward kept gamely going on TV and promoting his book. But again, there's a sense that this is sort of rehashed information and that the Democrats aren't really doing much with it as yet. And I'm not really sure where it's going as a story.
Kim Stressel, what about the drip torture? Lots of books out. Somebody this week saying the word in everyone is fiasco one way or another. This time it's denial. Is there more room for corrosion of respect for Republican leadership here? Or how do you read Woodward?
Well, I mean, one thing that's unfortunate is that it may be hard to actually get a good reading of how much traction Woodward's book is going to get because of what Julie said. It's been so eclipsed by other things. You know, up until then, the president had actually been making some real headway on the war in Iraq. The speeches that he had given seemed to be making themselves known in public approval ratings. Things were getting a little bit better. He was making his case.
And the polls reflected that.
And the polls certainly reflected that. But then you had both Woodward. You also had, remember, the National Intelligence Estimate flap a couple weeks ago, but because of this Foley static that's going on right there, this has taken things away from Iraq. We're not quite sure what that's going to mean. I mean, the president's approval ratings went down again recently, but is that because of his connection with the Republican Party overall, and the scandal that's going on? Actually, in a way, given some of the recent news, the Woodward news and the NIA thing. I agree with Julie that this might actually be sort of decent news for the Republicans because, if people are voting on Iraq, and I'm not sure that that's what they are doing, but if they are, this keeps the focus off.
Tom, I would also, also like to add that I think pretty quickly people are going to get Foley fatigue. The life of a scandal in Washington is shorter and shorter. And, like I said, we're almost 5 weeks out. We're just a little over 4 weeks out. And we could have two more scandals before the election. I don't think this Foley thing is going to hang around much longer. So the Iraq issue may reappear. But I agree with Kim. I think people are probably more interested in lower gas prices than they are in the conduct of the war, which hasn't really changed much in most people's lives.
With all those soldiers dying, I mean, if that doesn't turn your head, what is it? It's more than two dozen in this week, Jack. That's a very large death toll.
It is. And according to the Pew poll, it isn't gas prices. This is the overwhelming issue of the election. The voters have finally seen this, and they see it clearly, that this is a disaster. And I have been reading Woodward's book at the same time I'm reading the great book by Tom Ricks, Fiasco, and comparing their scenes, different moments. Mm. To read these books together is a sobering experience.
This is Tom Ricks, the Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent, spoke with us last summer about his very close reading of The Road to War in Iraq and the prosecution of that war.
Right. And to go from Woodward to the battlefront in Ricks is to go from a world where people scheme, where people try to, where Rumsfeld will not return the calls of Condi Rice, where the president seems unable to make Rumsfeld return the calls, where bureaucratic maneuvering and who's up and who's down matter,
What's new? This is Washington. I mean, isn't that always Washington
right.
people's
scheme? And, you know, let's look. I mean, Jack is making the case that the wars mattered. One thing that's actually really intriguing is that if you look back at the primaries that we've had and some of the early elections, one thing that struck both parties is turnout is down, but it's down almost equally in both parties. And that means that people just in general aren't happy with Washington at the moment. You would think that if there was this huge tidal wave against the war that you'd have increased Democratic turnout, for instance. But they're not seeing much from their own candidates that suggests they think that there's a big alternative there. And I do think that there are other issues that are going to have people going to the vote the polls and having them help decide what they're going to vote on. That is going to be, for instance, things like economic well-being.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack, I want to get you to your bottom line there, though. I mean, there's something
new. My bottom line, if I may get it out,
yes.
is just the juxtaposition of this world of pettiness and denial and the president not asking questions, not curious about the plan after the war, curiously passive, regarding himself more as a morale officer. I've got to be upbeat, and to be upbeat, you can't know any bad news. Contrasting that world to the world on the ground where these young men and women are putting their lives on the line for these men in Washington. It's a ghastly, ghastly contrast. And I think any American who reads both these books at the same time is going to come away frightened that all these people are still in power, still capable of making the kind of mistakes they've made here.
Let's take a call from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Nelson, you're on the air.
Oh, so much to say, so much to say. Thank you for letting me talk to you guys today.
Sure.
I wanted to lead into, I wanted to talk about the Foley thing, but then you guys went to Iraq, and I was like, well, you know, 40% of the president's approval rating has been in, what, the 40s and 30s for how long now? A year?
Quite a while, yeah.
Doesn't that pretty much tell you that most of America does not want to be in Iraq? Does me. But besides the point, I just wanted to bring up the point of, you know, there was Vietnam, and how that was ran through politicians, and we pretty much had to get out to save face on that. Then there's the Russians and how they got their butts kicked over in Afghanistan. They were there for 10 years. I mean, I think America really don't want it. It really does not want to be involved in any of those types of situations anymore.
Nelson, what do you do for a living, may I ask you?
Excuse me?
What do you do for a living?
I am a truck driver. I drive a Class 8 rig, 18 wheels.
You on the road right now?
Yes, I am.
So with all that going on, what about the other news this week? The stock market, an all-time high. Does it have you giddy with joy?
I don't follow the stock market that much. I follow more along the lines of, like, I'm a homeowner, so I'm concerned about interest rates and when they go up and when they go down. I'm concerned about the jobless rate.
And on the war front, you're saying enough already. Let's listen to the president for a moment here. It was hard for him to get the country's attention this week with all the Foley stuff going on. He was at a GOP fundraiser Tuesday in California, said that if the Democrats take control of Congress, the nation's stance against terrorism will soften.
There's a difference of opinion in Washington. If you listen closely to some of the leaders of the Democrat Party, it sounds like they think the best way to protect the American people is wait until we're attacked again.
Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, said he doesn't think the GOP will be able to recover from all their missteps.
The Republicans have dug this hole, and I think they're going to have trouble finding ladders tall enough to get them out of the holes they've dug.
That's the Democrats' hope anyway. Jack Beatty, what do you think about that? The president still wants to beat the national security drum. This week it sounded kind of high concept, kind of like a detached or abstract idea. I mean, with the trouble in Iraq, the trouble in Afghanistan, big nuclear signs all over North Korea, it seemed a little detached from the mounting challenges.
Well, that's his card, that we're in trouble, that we haven't had an attack in 5 years, that he's been doing something right to stop that, and that's the argument. If I might quibble about something, though, the president then used that formulation, the adjective Democrat, the Democrat Party. We don't say the Republic Party. That usage, you know, it sounds petty, but that goes back to Joe McCarthy. That they don't want to say Democratic, so they say Democrat. It's not grammar. It's not correct. And the president shouldn't use it. I noticed Hastert used it the other day. You know, if the Democrats should keep talked about the Republic Party. It makes no sense, and it's a deliberate effort.
Deliberate to do what? A kind of derogatory
To deny the word democratic. That's the adjectival form, and it's a long established tic, and it really should stop. It's too petty for words.
Something there about respect and partisan politics. Jimmy's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Jimmy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think about the week, Jimmy?
Well, to me, this all leads up to the big point of leadership, or I guess lack thereof. And for me, at least, as I listen to all these different calls and what's going on,
mm-hmm.
I feel like in the United States right now, we are kind of in a leadership vacuum in the sense of bringing people together. And I'm not putting this on the Republicans or the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a general rule. It seems like there's no leadership. No one's taking us in a direction that I think people are able to get behind and feel like we're going in the right direction. And, you know, I don't know that anyone's stepping up. And my question for everyone is, who do they see stepping up to lead this country, to move us forward and build consensus among everyone so that we can get beyond the polarization that we've had and really move to the next level?
You know, I like that question because when you look out there, it's scary and it doesn't seem like a time to be to be lost in kind of a partisan bickering and scandal and all the rest. Jimmy, thanks for your call. Kim, what about it? Who steps up? I mean, one of the analyses this week is that the Republicans are so bent on victory at any cost that they'll, you know, put anything under the rug to hang on to that. Republicans themselves saying that. I mean, within the Republican Party or without, where do you see or do you see a unifying figure, a unifying perspective out there?
You know, I mean, I think this was a fabulous question because it gets to the heart of what's happening in this election. You've got two different strategies going on here at the moment. You've got the Democrats who want this election to be a referendum on Republicans. I'm very much on that point that they have not provided leadership in Washington in their tenure there.
Well, and not only Democrats, I must say, we've heard this week from Republicans saying,
sure,
we're fed up with this crowd.
Sure.
We want this to be a referendum.
And then you have Republicans who, knowing how much trouble they are in, and they are in trouble, who are trying to make this election about instead saying, look, it's going to be worse with the other guys. Don't make this about us. Just look at how bad it's going to be on the other side if you get it. Now, I mean, there is some aspect of this which makes some political sense because, you know, as your caller just said, people want to know that the people they are voting for have a plan. And right now, among the Democrats, I think there is a general belief that actually it doesn't hurt them to not have a plan on Iraq because it just allows the debate to then come over to them and whether or not they've got an idea or not. But I think it's also a risk because Americans want to know that it's not enough for a lot of people to just say, we're going to vote for you because we don't like the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
They actually need to know that there's something that they are voting for, that there's a plan, that there is an idea out there for different leadership. And I'm not sure you've seen that as much as would be good for Democrats in this election.
I do believe people are going to focus on that more keenly before they actually cast that vote. We certainly will hear. Julie Mason, what about it on the Democrat side? And they were laying fairly low this week. We had Harry Reid there, but in general, Nancy Pelosi was out there, but in general, you know, they weren't doing a celebration dance over the Republicans' woes like they might. But what about the question? Do you see the leadership emerging there, the unifying leadership?
No, and I, in fact, Tom, I think that's something that's hurt the Democratic Party in the last few years. There's no strong leadership there. We talk about President Bush and the lack of popular support for the war in Iraq. But then when you poll Republicans, just Republicans, they still support him 80%. He's raised almost $200 million this year for this election. Right now, the Democrats, like the Republicans, are off campaigning. They're not here in Washington. They're not on the news. They're not taking a stance and a high profile to capitalize on this sort of bleak moment for the Republican Party. And like Kim said, I think they're hoping to win it in a default. I'm just not sure that gets it done.
Let's go to Ralph in Washington, D.C. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I have a real problem with Bush yelling, you know, the Democrats are soft on terrorism. He was in office 8.5 months. The first 4 months he was on vacation. There was warnings from the FBI. There was warnings from Egypt. There was warnings from Israel. There was a military organization that was forbidden to give the information. And then the terrorist thing happened. Gingrich accused Clinton of being fixated on this Osama bin Laden. He thought it was funny that Clinton was also enamored with it. You have Richard Clark's book that said that they did nothing. And then you have the book from Colin Powell that said they did nothing.
So you're not buying the soft on terrorism taunt from the GOP toward the Dems. Ralph, let us pick it up. Jack, you've been reading here again in Woodward and beyond. What about Ralph's point?
Well, the new item in Woodward is that there was a July 10th meeting, which hadn't been reported, or at least hadn't made it into the 9/11 Commission report, called by George Tenet and Kofor Black, the CIA operative, on an emergency basis. That is, with no appointment, practically, with Condoleezza Rice, the then National Security Advisor, and they said to her, "We're hearing noise. We're hearing chatter. We have to do something right now in Afghanistan to disrupt this. We don't know what's going to happen. Could happen here. Might not. We've got to act now." And she said, and she basically pushed them off. That's what they felt. And Black said, and he's on record as saying, "We practically put a gun to her head to get her to pay attention to this, and she did not." She said, "We have a study. We're looking at this." And they said, "You don't have time for the study. You got to act now." And she just pushed them off. Now, the same briefing, it turns out, was given to Rumsfeld. No action. The same briefing was given to John Ashcroft, the Attorney General. Well, he did take action. You know what he did? He stopped riding on coach. He stopped riding on commercial jetliners himself. He took a vacation.
That's a personal solution.
Yeah, that was his personal
horror.
Solution.
Kim Strassel, how about it? Condoleezza Rice has been out of town a lot of this week. But we read in your newspaper, The Wall Street Journal, Brett Stevens, on a she came in and talked with you all. And your colleague came away feeling like, oh, my gosh, you know, we've got so many problems in the world. And Condoleezza Rice is calling them all turbulence, as though we're automatically on our way to victory. His conclusion, as I read him, was, we're not so sure this is turbulence here, that we got some real problems. Is Condi in trouble out of the book? Is she in trouble out of the mounting number of challenges she's looking at?
Well, I mean, this is a woman who is dealing with half of the world at the moment. I mean, just look at the itinerary for a trip this week.
But
it's
is she dealing
to depress
with it?
You.
I mean, she's flying
well,
every place.
Well, no, I mean, part of the problem here is that the Bush administration is wrapped up in some problems that you got to wonder if they can actually fix. You know, Condi's been spending time in Palestinian areas in Israel. That is, at the moment, something that's, I think, stuck at a little bit of a standstill because you do have an organization running the PLO that is a terrorist outfit. And given that there were supposed to be some preconditions before we moved ahead in any sort of peace process, those have not been met.
But is that partly of the administration's own creating? There's been a lot of criticism of them not getting their hands in there earlier. I guess, does this stick to Rice, let's say, in a way that goes to her effectiveness? You know, we've got fires all over the place here.
Well, I'm sort of fascinated by that point because, let's remember, Hamas is now running this place. And, you know, there has been so much criticism over the years that the United States government has mollycoddled dictators, has gone along just for the sake of stability to, you know, work with terrorist outfits or work with people that harbor them. So now you actually have a woman who went to Egypt a while ago and said, "We're not going to take this anymore. We're going to have some preconditions. We're not going to just step back." And let's remember, too, she's not alone in this. It wasn't just the United States that decided to cut off aid to the Palestinian areas. It was the EU, too, who also felt it was beyond the pale that an organization, Hamas, was now running this place that had a known terrorist track record and also was refusing some basic aspect things like recognizing Israel's right to exist.
Julie Mason, how's Condoleezza Rice looking? She's been in the air over there, but the charges against her in Woodward's book are tough. And she's Secretary of State, and the affairs of state around the world look pretty troubled.
It's true. I think one of the effects of these books, including the ones that Jack has been talking about, has been sort of a popular, certainly at the elite level, but a popular reevaluation of especially her term as National Security Advisor and now the job she's doing, her effectiveness as Secretary of State. And I think that history is going to be a little tough on her. It might be too early to say, and she could rebound in the next 2 years and pull out something great. But I think that the situation in Lebanon over the summer didn't help her, and I think now the conduct of the war and this reevaluation of her handling of the entry into Iraq and now with Afghanistan going bad again, I think it's going to hurt her in ways that we really haven't seen the Secretary of State be damaged before.
Let me go to Richard in Kingstree, South Carolina. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I'm a small fry out here. I cut trees for a living, and now I work continuously every day. I listen at your show, and I'm very proud to be on it.
We're delighted to have you. What do you think? What do you see?
And what I see with President Bush, ever since he took office, he came in saying something that even to the workers, like, I know you've had a hard time, but would work harder. You know, I work from sunup to sundown to try to make a living, mm-hmm. and working hard is not going to get me anything. I have to work all night. And then he also came with a thing about Iraq, saying that, well, you know, we don't want it. We put somebody to attack us first. We are a very strong nation. I think we are the strongest nation in the world. That we can't take a slap on the cheek and then deal with it, then I think is a problem. And that same process, I think he's kind of like setting a bad precedent for the kids, because he says, well, you don't wait for somebody to attack you first if they threaten to attack you. Well, what would give the kids, that would give the kids more excuse to go to school and say, well, this guy threatened to attack me, so I attacked him first. The president said do it, so that's what we're doing. And I think he's setting a very bad precedent for the whole nation and for the whole world, and it's being the strongest country in the world. And I think he could handle it a whole lot better than he did.
Richard, we appreciate your call, and thank you so much for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jack Beatty, this president's no Amish man.
No, he's not. And Richard's point, you know, about preemptive strikes, this was, if not unique, because we heard from Noam Chomsky that it wasn't unique, that this view goes back to John Quincy Adams. But at least in modern times, the American doctrine has not been, we will strike first, and we won't even wait for evidence. And, of course, the trouble, as Richard raises, is if we do it, other countries can do it as well. And, of course, it hasn't turned out so well for us to understate it. If I might just go back for a second, Tom, quickly to a point Jimmy raised about, you know, a unifying candidate. It seems to me this is the very strongest argument that John McCain is going to be making. This is the kind of man he is. This is his. He works with Democrats. He's always been, you know, it's McCain-Feingold. It's McCain-Kennedy. Mm-hmm. It's whatever it is. And that feeling of how about somebody who can unite people, even though he's a strong conservative, I think that's the strongest argument Mr. McCain has going for him, hunger that people have.
Right, and that will be a powerful dynamic, as liberal critics say. But look, his voting record is as conservative as you can get, but in a time of such disunity, that's a strong dynamic. Let me get a call from Chicago. Alan is on the line. Hi, Alan, you're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to take the conversation back for a moment
sure.
to the Foley matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because I worked as a teacher in Florida. Okay?
Yep.
And as working there, my contract stated that I was required at the cost of my job and to aggressively report matters like his emails.
Not to fiddle and diddle around with it.
Exactly. And I think that it's appalling that anyone would suggest that a congressman should be held to a lesser standard than school teachers in his state.
Alan, we hear it loud and clear. Kim Strassel, this goes to your earlier characterization where it didn't look so bad, but you know, Americans have been long since sensitized to what goes on behind that kind of hanky-panky, and as Alan says, teachers have to, you know, stand up and address it or be fired.
Well, I mean, again, I think it goes back to we got to talk about this in a wider cultural sense. I mean, let's just imagine for a minute. Just play along with me here. Let's imagine that Hastert's team saw these emails and they decided it, based just on the emails, launch a huge investigation. And let's say there was nothing there in the end. Let's just say. Can you imagine the outrage that would have followed for the fact that this guy had been singled out? And let's put it on the table.
He but would his have been top aide was
because
also
he was gay.
His top aide was also Tom Reynolds' top aide. Now, come on,
because
Mr. Fordham. Do we really believe that Mr. Fordham, who worked so intimately with both of them, didn't know? I mean, can't they just talk to each other as grown-ups and say, "Hey, you know, what's going on here?" Do we believe that they didn't?
Okay, well, let's put it another way. Do you actually think this would have happened if it had been a guy sending an email to a woman?
To
because
a girl.
I don't.
To an underage girl saying, are you naked now?
This
or, you know, what
happens. Oh. Well, yeah, but this is not what we're talking again about the vanilla emails. Do you think an investigation would have been launched?
I mean, maybe you're right, but I just wonder if the conversation was as naive as the emails themselves among men who knew this man.
That's what this investigation will get into. But based on, I mean, and again, obviously, if they knew more than they're saying that they knew, that is an entirely different equation. But if you take them at their face value, what they say they actually knew, I'm not sure that if this had been a man sending an email to a younger woman, that anything would have happened.
Julie Mason, we've got 10 seconds before the end here. Is the Ethics Committee going to pop their findings before the election or after? What do you think?
No, absolutely not. They're going to get to work before the elections, but this is going to be, pushed off far beyond.
Julie Mason, White House and Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle, it's been great having you with us this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kim Strassel, editorial board member of the Wall Street Journal. Kim, great to have you again. Thanks for being
here. Great to be here.
Jack Beatty, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.